Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode, the latest chapter, latest outstanding revelations on life on Planet Porky with myself, of course, the Porkmeister, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. And Miss Jones, I saw something come out overnight, I think it was from Stateside, indicating that your book on John Lennon has now entered the pantheons of great literary rock books. Is this right?
Something like that, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's going so well. I've been really pleased. Because, as you know, it was a hard book to write. There have been so many books about John Lennon and the Beatles, and so a lot of competition out there. But you can only write the book that you want to write. And that's what I say in so many of these writers' workshops and that kind of thing.
Yes.
You know, it has to be the book that comes from your heart.
Yes.
And hopefully that stood me in a bit of good stead this time.
Excellent. Well, I'm delighted. Well done. Now, Ms. Jones, one thing I want to talk to you about. I feel very strongly about this. You, of course, have had three children. They're all high achievers in life, you know, in their individual ways. And I have to say how amazed I was to find out that the son of Tony Blair, his name is Ewan, is now worth 70 million quid. And you know what? I say good on him. I don't even say, well, he got a leg up from his dad, because I've read the story. It doesn't appear he did. He started a business on his own. He's doing extremely well. I say good luck to him. And surely that justifies, you know, every parent's belief in their children.
It's going to invite criticism, isn't it? This kind of thing, because Tony Blair has his adversaries, his critics. He has made millions in some of the shadiest corners of the world. We know that.
He has.
And I think the kids will have had a leg up from their parents.
Yes.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, they were helped to buy their properties, that kind of thing. So they haven't faced the usual challenges that young people tend to in terms of putting a roof over their heads and finding a job and supporting themselves, all that kind of thing. Mm. They've been lucky kids from the start.
They have been lucky kids, but you will know also it's your prerogative and your right as a parent, if you're successful, to pass on all your experience and, if necessary, some monetary aid to your children to set them on the way in life, isn't it?
Yeah. And this startup that he came up with, it's an educational company called Multiverse, which helps young people to find apprenticeships. It's a worthy cause. And the fact that the company's gone on to make 150 million, and I think his share is half of it, something like that. You know, we have to say good on him, because it's not for a seedy reason. It's for something that serves society.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I know what you mean about the Tony Blair accusations, but much closer to home, do you remember my old editor, Nick Lloyd, who became Sir Nick Lloyd? Did you ever meet Nick?
Yeah, loads of times.
Yeah, of course. He lived
in the same thrown out of pubs with Nick Lloyd.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah, he's a very nice man. Good guy to work for, but you never felt any threat from Nick as the editor. Nick was just too nice a guy. And Nick just wanted an easy life, to be honest. You know, he just wanted to get a knighthood off Mrs. Thatcher for supporting her throughout her years in Downing Street, which he got. And most of the time, Nick was more interested in playing golf than running a newspaper. And I say that with the greatest of affection, because he never, you know, shouted at me. He sacked me in the end because he was on, he was under pressure from a lot of the rest of the staff who thought I was a grotesque, misogynistic bully. That's the women in the office. And the blokes thought that I was a bit too harsh on them. I was, in fact, just efficient and driven and all those sort of things, you know. But but there we are. But he couldn't even face me when he sacked me. Michael, he was looking at the floor, shuffling his feet. Oh, I want to make changes, you know. I said, yeah, I'm with you on that, Nick. I think we should make a load of changes. Get rid of A, get rid of B, get rid of C and all that. And in the end, he said, no, I'm afraid it's you that's got to change.
Well, very good. Yeah. I mean, every dog has its day.
Every dog has its day. Anyway, the point of talking about Nick was eventually Nick got the boot the same way, as we all do in Fleet Street. And then he set up a PR agency, and he made an awful lot of money dealing with some what you would call questionable overseas governments and agencies and all that. And that's where all the money was in those days when Blair was doing it, because people suddenly started realising the value of international PR. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he made a load of osh. But anyway, there you go. So then move on to somebody else's child who's doing extremely well. And I'm now talking about Romeo Beckham. Have you seen the astonishing modelling pictures of this boy? Not only do I think he's got striking good looks and pose and looks the part, but of course, he's the son of one of the world's most famous footballers, one of the world's most famous fashion designers stroke female pop stars.
Astonishing pictures. He looks exactly like his mother. Yeah. Those photographs could be Victoria Beckham, couldn't they?
Yes, they could. Well, how come, you know, famous and successful people always have very good-looking children? Because, of course, Donald Trump's just left the White House. And, I mean, the collection of his offsprings and his children and his, you know, his wife, they're all very good-looking people.
Well, if you start off with a very, very good-looking father and a beautiful mother, you're going to get gorgeous children, because that's all about genes.
Yeah, well, I suppose it is. But what I would say about Romeo, of course, he's got a huge advantage having a father like David Beckham, mother like Posh Spice or Victoria. But he genuinely is outstanding, isn't he? You know, those pictures are mind-blowing. When you look at them, they catch the eye.
Yeah, well, don't forget that an awful lot goes into pictures like that. You know, it's all about lighting, it's all about the setup, the angle, the pose. You get a great photographer, he can get a good picture out of anybody. I'm not denigrating Romeo Beckham. I'm sure he's gorgeous in the flesh. Yes. He has got those good genes that are required. But he photographs very well. Yeah. You're lucky if you do.
That's right, absolutely.
He reminds me a bit, I have to say, of the child of Liz Hurley, whose name I can't remember.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Who looks like
Damien.
That's right.
And he's got long hair sort of down to his waist, and he's another one who's the dead spit of his mum.
I totally agree. There's something a bit weird about that boy, though. He seems like taking pictures of his mother when she's in bikinis and all her knockers are hanging out and all that kind of stuff.
She's only got two, but a little bit dodgy, yeah.
Yes. Well, sorry, she's only got two what?
Knockers.
What
you said that? All her knockers.
Well,
I
you know what I mean.
Maybe she's got a third kind of one knocking around on the back.
I see what's going on here, Miss Jones. You're trying to make that out that you're the wordsmith, eh? And I'm the ignoramus when it comes to the English language, eh?
Well, let's not do anus as well.
Excuse me. I didn't say that, you know.
Oh, didn't you?
Okay. No, I didn't. Anyway, listen, it's the
It's a family show,
it is, and let's keep it as a family show. It's also the 50th birthday of Gary Barlow. Now, you've got to say Gary Barlow is a success story, isn't he?
Yeah, I don't really like him very much, but yes, he is. I've never really gone for Take That music.
Right.
Just found them a bit smarmy. I'm obviously too old for Take That. You know, they came along after my sort of pop era, but I just never went for them. I never thought they were that good.
No, I totally agree. If they, to me, they were the first boy band. I know there were Irish bands before that, put together by that bloke who was the judge on Has Britain Got Talent? What's his name?
Louis Walsh.
Louis Walsh, that's right. He brought all these bands over from Ireland, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, initially. So they were the first thing around. And of course, you know, me, even more so than you, came from an era of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, because I'm a bit older than you. And so I appreciated their music at a sort of, you know, 10, 12 or something like that. And I was, you know, sort of forged in that sort of music. So when I see a group of young lads on the stage just singing, then as far as I'm concerned, they're just a sing and dance group. They're not musicians. I never saw one of them pick up a musical instrument. Did you?
Well, Gary Barlow obviously plays the piano brilliantly, but the others just kind of jigged around, didn't they?
That's what I mean,
I never got it. I didn't like the songs. I found them sort of, I don't know, saccharine sweet. They
Just so boring.
And they did a lot of cover versions, crucially. Yeah. You know, they murdered some of the great songs like Could It Be Magic, Barry Manilow, and How Deep Is Your Love, the Bee Gees. It Only Takes a Minute, Tavares. I mean, what was wrong with the original? I just didn't get them. I thought they were a bit of a vehicle for other people's songwriting.
They were, but when they sung their own, they didn't really sound like songs. I remember the lyrics to one of them was, You know, downstairs, the taxi's waiting. Everything changes but you. And it didn't even sound like a song. You know what I mean?
It sounds like it's on its way to a song. Yeah, the other thing, Robbie Williams was always a bit Emperor's New Clothes for me.
Yeah.
I would listen to him and watch him and think, is it me or is everybody else getting a point that I just can't see here? I just don't think he's any good.
No. Listen, how much do I agree with you? When I read that Robbie Williams now lives in a £10.6 million house, which is next door, of course, to Jimmy Page, and they're having this great dispute over who's going to dig a basement under it.
A bigger digger,
yeah, sorry. Yeah, come on, Miss Jones, honestly. You know, it's you who keeps, you know, putting in the old double entendres again.
Definitely not me.
The digger, bigger digger. So what I was going to say was, I totally agree with you. And Robbie Williams, again, was just a singer. But then one night I was with some friends and he was on some variety show and he sung Frank Sinatra's My Way and dedicated it to his mum. And, you know, the audience at the London Palladium were rapturous. And I thought, wow, talk about murdering the, you know, complete Frank Sinatra song. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, no, I just, I'm glad you agree, because I sometimes think, you know, maybe I've lost my reason, maybe I don't have any taste anymore, but the fact that we're both on the same page about something like that.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, definitely. As I said, everything changes but you. just on Take That, they came into the office once when I was at The Sun and Mackenzie was there and he had the same opinion about them as me. He was this scruffy bunch. And, of course, it was Piers Morgan who brought them in, you know.
Well, he wrote their book. Well, he did their biography of the band.
Well, I was responsible for that because I was the executive editor and Piers was doing Bizarre. And he brought these in and you know, Mackenzie just threw them out the office, basically. He just thought they were four kids running around, you know, couldn't imagine them ever be pop stars. And actually told the little one, you know, the little cheeky one, is it Marky or somebody?
Mark Owen,
to F off when Mark Owen asked if he could have an apple from his fruit bowl.
Was that a euphemism?
Yes. No, he did. Mackenzie always had this bowl of fruit in his office. You know, it was have your five a day, you know, so he'd munch an apple and a banana or something like that. And Mark Owen went to take an apple out of his bowl and he'd hey, put it back. Don't you let me know, chef, you know, you know. So it wasn't a great instruction. Anyway, so after they'd gone, Piers came to me and said, I remember exactly what he said. He said, can I have a word in your shell like? And I said, yeah.
And you said, excuse me?
Exactly. Yeah. And Piers said, look, he said, they're going to be the biggest thing in the world. I said, come off it, Piers. I said, they're four scruffy lads from Manchester. I said, what are you on about? He said, no, they are. And he said, I'm going to help promote them. He said, and look, I'm going to write their book. I said, write a book about a group nobody's ever heard of. He said, don't worry, by the time the book comes out, they'll have had three number ones. And Piers was absolutely right. And the book was a bestseller. And we serialised it in the paper. And I signed a bit of paper giving Piers 50 grand for the book before the book had even been written. So it was a very good spot by Mr. Morgan.
And where was your cut?
No, I didn't take a cut. I was honest in those days. Well, I'm honest now, obviously, you know.
Oh, you live and learning.
Never learning. Talking about birthdays, maybe somebody who you rate a little bit higher as a singer. What about Will Young, who's 42?
Oh, yeah, he's not bad. He won the very first Pop Idol.
Did he?
In 2002, yeah. In fact, he read politics at Exeter University, where two of my kids went. And then he went on to Arts Educational, where my son Henry went also. So he put, yeah, but he dumped his studies. This was what I always thought was a bit dodgy about Will.
Yes.
He kind of quit school to go on television and be a contestant on a pop show, which he went down a little bit in my estimation, but then he won.
Yeah.
And then he had a very troubled life, didn't he, since then?
What, because, bit of depression was it, I think, or something?
Well, he came out as gay the same year he won, which in 2002 was quite a big thing to do. You know, we don't think anything of that now, and quite rightly so.
Yeah.
Anybody who wants to identify as homosexual should be allowed to and should be able to live that way. That's the way of the world today. But it wasn't like that back then. Mm. He only came out because he was threatened by a tabloid, unfortunately, who were hounding him.
Yeah.
And they were going to out him, so he decided to do that himself. But he had a twin brother called Rupert,
right?
Who tragically died last year. They both had mental health issues.
Oh dear, that's very sad. Yeah,
it's a very devastating loss, and of course, losing a twin—that's a huge thing. I was talking to a guy I know in America last night.
Yeah.
We were talking about the inauguration, actually.
Yeah.
And his marriage has recently broken down. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, my wife's twin sister came between us. And I thought, what a terrible thing that is. You know, it's an imbalance before you start, isn't it? If you're a twin and you try to have a relationship outside of your twinship, then that is a recipe for disaster. And it was for Will Young.
Do you know, when you said that, my wife's twin sister came between us. I don't know why. Maybe I've got a weird mind.
Oh, you've got a dirty mind.
I immediately thought about them having a threesome. you know, because, you know, when you read all these agony aunt columns, Dear Deirdre and all that, apparently that's quite the thing to have, to have a sexual encounter with twins, apparently.
Oh,
you know, how would I know, you know?
Moving swiftly on,
moving swiftly on. Let's move swiftly on to a subject that I've been much maligned about this week, Miss Jones. It's everybody knows, because they listen to our podcast, that Harry's, who are a company who produce razors and shaving gel, and it's an online business, and they are a supporter of our podcast, were featured in our last podcast. So I did a little picture of myself, you know, having a shave. And of course, when a man has a shave, he sort of strains his neck up to show that, you know, the blade is lovely and smooth and all that. And then all these horrible people started sending me Twitter messages and things saying, look at all your nasal hair. But I make absolutely sure there is not, because there never is. So I thought I was much maligned there. And also, I was doing television the next day. I was doing Jeremy Vine. So I'm always very careful to have myself properly groomed for that. So I think I've been treated a bit unfairly.
Yes, you have. You're a fastidious gentleman. And
very kind of you.
I have studied your face at point blank range many a time, and I can assure our listeners there ain't no nasal hair in there.
Thank you very much indeed. It's because I've got a moustache on my top lip, and so it's very, you know, sometimes easy to confuse it. But believe me, there ain't no nasal around me. You're absolutely right. Now, I want to tell you this funny story, Ms. Jones. When the Rolling Stones played the Nebworth Festival in Hertfordshire in 1976, you wouldn't have been there in 76, of course, you're far too young, but I bet you've done that festival a few times, haven't you?
Yeah, I did go to Nebworth a few times. Queen played their last ever gig there in 1986. So that was about my level. I came in then, but no, I wasn't there in 76. I was still at school.
Of course. Now, have you ever had an experience like this? Because it was in Nebworth, the local newspaper is the Stevenage Gazette, okay? So what happened was Mick Jagger read down the list of requests from media for interviews, and he said, all right. We'll do New York Times and Melody Maker. What's this one here? Stevenage Gazette. Yeah, we'll do that as well, right? So he did the New York Times, did the Melody Maker. This kid then comes from the Stevenage Gazette. Apparently, it was one of his first ever jobs. He was about 17, and he was very nervous, you know. So the kid comes up to Mick Jagger. Can you imagine that, honestly? You know, Mick Jagger, one of the, you know, the biggest, most iconic rock stars in the world, and you're doing your first week on the Stevenage Gazette, 17, you go up. And the kid said to Mick Jagger, what do you think of Stevenage, Mr. Jagger? And Mick Jagger said, nah, son, you don't want to do that. Ask me about Bianca. Now, have you ever had an experience like that in your early days, Miss Jones? Because it really is terrifying, isn't it?
Well, it is. And the only way we learn how to do that job, how to interview celebrities, is to do it and to make all the mistakes in the book.
Yeah.
So, you know, you approach these things tentatively, and you're sweating and you're nervous, and you've got a list of questions in your spirally bound reporter's notebook. And you do make an idiot of yourself for the first few times, but you learn on the job. That's the only way.
Yes, no, I think it is. Did I tell you I once interviewed Will Farrell? Is he the very famous American actor?
Oh, the one that was in Elf.
Yes, that's him. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it Will Ferrell or Will Farrell?
I think it's Farrell, but I wouldn't put money on it.
But it was one of these situations, which you must have had a million times. They book a boutique hotel in Soho, right? and then everybody sits in the bar next door until they're summoned. You know what I mean?
Mm. Well, nowadays they don't even do that. They do a junket now. So you all sit round a table and put your microphone in the middle.
Right.
You know, you've all got your recording devices.
Yeah.
All the mics in the middle, and everybody gets the answers to everybody else's questions, which I just think is stupid.
Pathetic. How do you get an exclusive line?
Well, you don't, do you? So you might as well just hand out a press release.
You might as well just send somebody else to do it for you. You know, yeah. If it's just a recording, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. It's very boring. We used to get exclusive interviews one-to-one,
yeah.
Or one-on-one, as they insist on saying in America.
Yes.
But in those days, we did go for the exclusive lines.
And yeah, of course.
We went for the jugular. And, you know, if you got nothing, you applied the Columbo technique, which was to wrap it up, say, thank you very much, Mr. Jagger. Lovely to see you. And off you'd go towards the door. And just as you hit the door handle, you'd turn around and go, just one more thing.
Yes.
Yeah. And throw the bomb, yeah. The killer question,
yeah.
Whatever it happened to be. And then you would get some outrageous answer and there was your headline.
Yeah, or you'd get some outrageous PR jumping in and say, that wasn't on the list or something like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, more likely.
And that's it. But anyway, look, good luck to the boy. No, Will Farrell thing was, I didn't even know we were doing it. We'd finished doing a show between 10 and 1 and we were just leaving the building and suddenly somebody said, oh, listen, we've got a great opportunity to go and see. I didn't even know who Will Farrell was, seriously. And when we went into the room, there were two actors there and I started talking to the wrong one, thinking he was Will Farrell. you know, that I was that ignorant of it. And this guy got quite upset. Will Farrell got quite upset when we started talking about whichever film he was promoting and I didn't know the name of the film. I don't know why they sent me. I think whoever was going to do it must have dropped out. And they asked us if we wanted to go. So we did. And anyway, there we go.
I did something similar, by the way, years ago. There are two guys, and to this day, I can't remember the names or the difference.
Right.
One of them was called Tony Head. And the other one was... Yeah, good job.
That's a famous joke, of course. Good job his mum didn't call him Richard. But anyway, yeah, go on. Yeah.
But the other one was called something else Head. And yeah. I was sent off to interview this guy. I think the other one was in Chess, the musical or something.
Yeah.
And the other one was in a coffee advert on telly with Sharon Morm, the one with really long hair. Do you remember that one?
It was where they were trying to have a romance in the advert, wasn't
it?
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And I went to interview this guy, whatever he was called, Head.
Yeah.
And I thought he was the other one. So I was interviewing him about the coffee ad,
right, yeah.
Whereas he was actually the one who was in the musical or something.
Right.
And it was two-thirds of the way through the interview before he actually went, I'm not him, I'm the other one.
Golly, yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, we all make mistakes.
Yeah, yeah, no, horribly embarrassing. It's when the star actually finds that funny and amusing that, you know, actually it's not going to be too bad. It's when they take... The smaller the stars are, the more umbrage they take at basic errors, don't they?
Yeah. So true.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. We've just had a short break there, and I heard a bit of a spluttering noise coming from the other studio. Are you all right there, Miss Jones? You haven't been on the cherry on the cornflakes again, have we, this morning, huh?
Oh, no, not yet.
Not yet,
time.
Eh? Mm. Yeah. Now, I want to tell you something, Ms. Jones. I've been doing a bit of telly this week, and of course, it's now all done from home studios, and I've built myself a little home studio in my office, you know, at Chez Paris. And for TV, I always put a bunch of flowers in the background, and I've had some tremendous messages asking if I arrange them myself, and I did, and they're beautiful. They're roses with lots of leaves, so I'm quite proud of that.
Yeah, very good. I mean, you know, give the readers something nice to look at.
Or even the viewers.
Even the viewers, it looks like you've made an effort.
Yeah,
you're
exactly.
proud of your surroundings.
Yeah.
And you're upbeat in life and you enjoy flora and fauna and all those kinds of things.
Absolutely right. Now then, Boris Johnson and Theresa May. I mean, just to recap on the history of it, Theresa May was Prime Minister. She made Boris Johnson Foreign Secretary. It was said at the time the reason she made him Foreign Secretary was because she couldn't stand him, but he was a populist and, you know, was quite popular amongst the backbenchers, so get him into the cabinet. But give him Foreign Secretary, make sure he spent most of his time abroad, not bothering anybody. Now, the history again of it, of course, is that Boris Johnson eventually rebelled against what she called the Chequers Agreement, which was the Brexit agreement she came up with, which was roundly rejected by everybody. He eventually stepped down, resigned as Foreign Secretary, and went off into the political wilderness. But of course, politics being politics, he then ends up as the Tory leader and the new Prime Minister, and Theresa May is on the back benches. Now, what happened next?
Well, she's not very happy about it, is she? And she's never forgiven him for usurping her, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think the mistake she made was to stay in government, to stay on the back benches. Yes, I don't think you can go back from being Prime Minister to being just a constituent MP, can you? Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Just to recap for our listeners, this week, of course, she gave an exclusive interview to the Daily Mail, a paper you and I are very much aware of. And it's for some unknown reason, lacerated Boris as having let the country down, lacked leadership in world politics. And all this was all about the negotiations to get Brexit through. She was a Remainer anyway. She should never have been a Brexit Prime Minister, but she really lashed out at him. And just this morning, Boris has hit back and said, I really don't know what she's talking about. It's water off a duck's back. You know, let's just get on with life. But on that situation about should you stay in, there's two points of view on this. So the first one is when David Cameron realised he'd made a terrible error in backing Remain, and that only to find the country overturned his wishes and voted for Brexit, he immediately stood down, and the reaction to that was divided. Half of the Tories said, what a coward to walk away. He should have summoned himself together, pulled himself up and got us through Brexit. And showed leadership. The other half said, absolutely right, what an honourable man. He said we should remain in Europe. The country voted against it, so he went immediately. And of the two, I rather admire Theresa May more for going back onto the back benches and doing her job for her constituents than just flouncing off into the sunset.
Do you? Okay. Well, first of all, I thought that David Cameron was a coward and he should have stood up to the plate and he should have led us through Brexit. Yep. And it wouldn't have taken as long and it wouldn't have been the horror story that it became had he done that.
Yes.
So I think I lost a lot of respect for him over that.
Yeah.
But Theresa May is obviously a very bitter woman. Whatever she has to say about Boris and about what happened is not of any interest to anybody now. Yep. We're in the worst pandemic the world has ever seen.
Indeed.
And that's all that matters is getting the country out of that now.
Yes.
So let's not bitch about Boris and Daily Mail, you know, go to the back for having given her a platform to say all this.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with all of that. So, talking about Boris, by the way, somebody leaked a story this week, which he's roundly denied, that he likes the half-hour power nap during his working day. He gets up very early, he works till late. So at some part of the day, he'll ask all his aides to leave his office, he closes the door and he puts his feet up and he actually dozes for 30 minutes. I can't think of anything worse that would drive me mad than trying to take a 30-minute sleep break in my day. What about you?
No, not at all. I have tried it as an experiment. And the trouble is you relax and then you can't wake up again. Yep. So it's an inappropriate time of the day to try and rest. You've got to get up, you've got to keep going, and then you've got to sleep at night.
Yeah.
There is a school of thought that suggests that dementia, Alzheimer's, that kind of thing can derive from lack of sleep. Lady Thatcher famously did without very much sleep at all, didn't she?
Yes.
She had three or four hours.
Night. 4 or 5 hours, yeah. Yeah.
So she ended up with dementia
in the end.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
no.
You know, we need to take heed of that kind of thing.
And yes.
Get our sleep at the appropriate time, I think.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. You see, sometimes I have very long days. When I used to do the breakfast show, I was up at 3:30 in the morning. The car came at 5 o'clock. I was up at 3:30. The car came at 4:30. I was in the office at 5:00, had an hour to sort things out before going on air at 6:00. Come off air at 10:00, but I was a programme director, so I stayed around until 2:30 or 3:00, and then handed over to my deputy, right? So I was on my way home then at 4:00, have a few beers, 5:00, 6:00, and I daren't go to sleep when I got in at 6:00 because I didn't want to, although I was very, very tired, you know, because I got up at 3:30, but I didn't want to sleep through until 3:30 the next morning, 9.5 hours. There were news programmes to watch and all this kind of stuff, you know. But I daren't either go and get my head down for 30 minutes, you know, as a bit of a break, because I would have got up feeling so groggy and awful after a couple of pints on the way home. It just wouldn't work. So I'm like you. I have to stay up until I'm, you know, going to bed for a night's sleep. And if that means a very long, extended, tired day, I'd rather that than lying down.
Totally. And the other thing was when we used to travel a lot.
Oh, yes.
You know, I was in America every week at one point.
Yes.
And you had to hit the ground running. You had to adopt local time as soon as you arrived.
Yes.
And not sort of go to your hotel and have a sleep before you started work. We couldn't do that anyway, because we were there for a reason. But the idea to get over jet lag was always to just adopt the local time as soon as you arrived and go to sleep at the normal time there.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I remember one time I was in California, and I'd been there for that week anyway, whatever job I was doing. And we were in the King's Head in Santa Monica, and some idiot from the Mirror turned up, to start working on the same story I was working on. I can't remember what it was, but obviously it was going on for a while. And this guy was quite old. He was in his sort of mid-50s, quite old compared to me in those days. I was in my sort of early 30s, you know. And he'd never actually done the flight from London to LA before, right? You know, and he didn't know anything about jet lag and all that. I remember we were standing in the bar at the King's Head. The more drinks he had, the more incredibly drunk he was getting, because he didn't realise...
Well, that's the usual way, yes.
Yeah, seriously. No, yes, I know. But what I mean is he didn't realise the strains that jet lag was putting on his body, because he probably hadn't been to sleep now for about 30 hours or something, you know. Mm. And he was going, fucking jet lag. He says, you youngsters, you know, fucking, I've been in this game for 30 fucking years, you know. And all of a sudden he went like, you know, bright red and then white, and he collapsed and smashed his head on the floor. All as a result of jet lag. Yeah, seriously. But that's the way we were in those days. Talking about that, because it reminds you of somebody from the Mirror, did you pick up on a serialization from a new book on our old friend Mr. Robert Maxwell?
Yeah, we talked about that last week.
No, we didn't, did we? I don't think we did.
I think we talked off the record. Yes.
Oh, yeah, talked off the record. Yeah.
Yeah, this guy, he made The Dig, didn't he? Well, he wrote The Dig, which was turned into a TV series. He wrote another thing that was turned into a film. Can't remember.
Really?
This Maxwell story is obviously heading for the screen.
Oh yeah, definitely. But there's more and more revelations in it about what a really revolting piece of work Maxwell was. But the one story I keep forgetting to tell you about Maxwell was when I worked in New York, that was when Maxwell took over, right? I was working for the Express in New York, and the Mail and the Mirror offices, New York bureaus, were all in the same building. We were in the news building on 42nd Street, which was the Superman building, you know, where Superman was filmed, because it was the home of the New York Daily News. And there was a guy there who I shan't mention, but he was in the Mirror bureau. Head of the Mirror Bureau, you may know him. And the minute that Maxwell took over the Mirror in London, he suddenly disappeared. He got on a plane, flew back to London, and went straight to the Mirror offices to find the new owner, Robert Maxwell, and tell him to sack the current editor, whose name was Mike Malloy, who we've talked about before, and install him as editor. He went completely mad. Nobody took any notice of him.
How very odd. No, I've just remembered this guy, John Preston, who wrote the Maxwell book.
Yes.
He also wrote A Very English Scandal.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. With Hugh, what's his name?
Hugh Grant. Yeah, Hugh out for a TV series or a film. I mean, the dark workings of a very complex and damaged mind, isn't it? This is the thing that fascinates us about people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why Ghislaine, I understand that's how you pronounce her name, is now still in a Brooklyn jail in America, awaiting charges, all sorts of alleged crimes involving young girls and the, financier, forgotten his name, what's his name?
Jeffrey Epstein.
Jeffrey Epstein, well done. And she is really the daughter of a father, isn't she, when you read some of the...
Well, most people are, yes.
Yes, well, that's right. But I mean, you know, and talk about, you know, the dark arts of life. She seems to have been practising a few, according to her prosecutors, all allegations, of course.
I'm looking forward to that trial, I have to say, because there are three sides to every story, his, hers and the truth.
Right.
And that trial is going to be a trial of the century, isn't it?
Yes, but you'll never get his side now because he's dead, of course.
You won't get his side, but you might get some insight into the father and into why she became the kind of woman she did.
Maybe, maybe. You could well be right. You may get all of that. I still don't think, and I will stick to this, I've said it from the start, I still do not think she will ever appear in a courtroom to give evidence. I think there are far too many people, and you are talking here about huge international billionaires. You're talking about businessmen, billionaires, politicians, all involved in the scandal surrounding Jeffrey Epstein, all at some time or another involved in his seedy world. We already know the Duke of York was. So if the Duke of York was, who else was around the world? And I don't think some people and some regimes can ever allow her to get into a courtroom.
Well, doesn't it explain why Jeffrey Epstein died in a prison cell?
Yes, it does. I think Jeffrey Epstein was murdered.
So do I. Yeah, I've always thought that.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think, I think the closer it gets to her court date, I think the more you'll find something's going to happen and she will never appear in a courtroom. What is astonishing is that she wasn't even allowed out of jail after pulling up bail of nearly $30 million. I mean,
well, she was a flight risk. They couldn't possibly allow that.
I know what you mean. Even though the focus of, you know, the whole world is on her, you still think she could have escaped from America.
Absolutely. These people do the most bizarre things, like go off and have plastic surgery and, you know, they've got 5 fake passports lined up and that kind of thing.
She would have
disappeared into the underworld and never been heard of again.
I so agree with you. That, and by the way, she would have been assisted in that by the very people I'm talking about. She could have lived the rest of her life in Saudi Arabia without anybody knowing it. You know what I mean? Or something like that.
Yeah. But there are too many people with too much to lose.
I totally agree. I just cannot see her. I mean, bearing in mind that American trials are often televised, I can't see her being on a television screen all around the world revealing details from a little black book of some world leader somewhere or somebody very close to a world leader who's been involved with Jeffrey Epstein.
And if she did do that, if she did spill the beans, she wouldn't live very long, would she? Somebody would get to her.
Yeah, but you see, that's why I don't think she'll ever appear in a courtroom. I think she is a liability alive. And I know it sounds like something out of a John le Carré book to say, what do you mean? She'll never make it to a courtroom. But stranger things have happened in this world. If it involved, for instance, anybody to do with Israel, Mossad would take her out. I mean, they just would. You know what I mean? It's that sort of scenario. But anyway, look, probably getting above myself here. I'll have to start thinking about putting all that into a book, obviously. I've got a great mind for spies. Now, tell me this, Miss Jones. We'll have great memories of childhood and all that kind of stuff. And apparently, people are now turning to comfort food, the sort of food they ate as a youngster when they were growing up, because it reminds them of better times. It reminds them of being safe and secure with their mum and dad in their family home. And there was nothing like COVID about. There were no lockdowns. You were not being told you couldn't go to work. And apparently one of those foods that reminds everybody of this are the tinned pies and meats of Frey Bentos. Are you amongst the fans of Frey Bentos?
Well, not in the present day, but I can remember eating Frey Bentos steak and kidney pie when I was a child.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. If that's what turns you on, then go ahead and have some.
I totally agree.
But I had a conversation with my children quite recently about the kind of meals we eat today compared with the kind of dinners I was served when I was a kid.
Right.
And it couldn't be more different. You know, in our day, spaghetti came in a tin and you had it on toast.
Yeah.
We didn't have foreign food in those days. That hadn't happened yet. So you didn't even have Chinese food. The closest you ever got to that was a Vesta prawn curry or something.
I love those Vesta curries. Do you know what I liked? I liked the Vesta beef curry, and the beef in them it didn't even look like beef. They looked like pellets. They looked like sort of slug pellets. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
No, they did. Honestly. And it was only when you put them in water and heated them up that they sort of melted into proper meat and all that kind of stuff. I used to, and they used to put some like fruits in it, you know, like, I don't know, what do you put in a curry that's fruity?
It's a pineapple and stuff.
Say again?
bits of pineapple and onion.
That's right. Or a bit of apple or something like that. And my God, I used to love them. I used to tell my mum to get me them all the time. I used to love them, honestly. And I ate a few of the Fray Bentos. But you're so right about foreign food. I mean, we never had any foreign food in our house. You're absolutely right about spaghetti. Spaghetti was just an alternative to beans, really, in a tin, wasn't it?
Yeah, you had it on toast. And other foods that we had, we'd have things like fried egg and chips, or we'd have liver and bacon. That was a kind of stalwart.
Sunday
was always a Sunday lunch, you know, chicken or a bit of lamb. And then you'd have the leftovers on Monday for dinner.
Throughout
the week, a lot of the food involved chips. My mother had a chip pan.
Yeah.
And the chip pan used to catch fire. Yeah. I mean, imagine having a chip pan now.
Oh, no, I know. I totally agree. Believe it or not, when we were like little kids, so I'm talking about, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 or something like that, sometimes our meal of an evening at home, because, you know, our dad used to get home late. He didn't get home till about 8 o'clock or something. And so mum would cook him something separate. But we, through popular demand, would just ask mum for a big plate of chips and bread and butter. And we used to love eating chip butties for tea.
Yeah, we ate a lot of potatoes, didn't we?
Yeah.
But you also used to love, this is weird, I've never met anybody else who liked a crisp sandwich.
Yes, I did.
Crisp sandwiches were great, weren't they?
I had crisp sandwiches. I had sugar sandwiches. I loved putting sugar on a sandwich. And I had apple sandwiches.
Oh, and the other one, salad cream sandwiches.
I wasn't actually into salad cream.
I loved salad cream. Not mayonnaise. It had to be salad cream out of a bottle.
Yeah, I wasn't into that. But what I did love was fried bread. You know, when all the bacon had been cooked and all that, my mum would always drop a slice of bread into the fat, and it was fried bread, and I used to love it. You know, but anyway, there we are. As for foreign food, I didn't eat anything Chinese until I was about 23, right? And I didn't have my first.
You made a note of the day, did you?
well, no, but I remember where I was when I had my first one. I was working in the northeast in North Shields, actually, in the district office of the Newcastle Evening Chronicle. And I remember after work one night, we had a few pints in the pub across the road, and then one of them said, "Come on, let's go to the we used to call it the Chinky in those days. I know that's an unacceptable
Really can't say that anymore.
No, you can't, but that's what we used to call it, and it was the northeast of England, you know. And I'm not suggesting people in the northeast of England are ignorant or anything like that, but it was just a local dialect type thing, you know. And and I said, "What do you mean?" And they said, "Yeah, we'll go to the Chinese." I said, I'm sorry, why do you eat Chinese? You know, I thought, you're not Chinese, so why are you eating Chinese food? And I didn't get it, you know. So they said, no, it's lovely. I said, I couldn't eat Chinese food. I thought it must be like snake or something like that. You know what I mean?
Oh, no.
No, yes. Ugh. Seriously. So they said, no, come on, you'll love it, you know. And I said, well, do they serve like beef? And, oh, God, yeah, chicken. Oh, yeah. I said, and what sauces they put in it? Come on. Anyway, I'd had a few pints of lager. I went in there and I was captivated. It was so delicious. And I became a Chinese food devotee forever. But it was another few years before I did the same with an Indian restaurant. I didn't think I'd like Indian food, and I love it. So a lesson in life.
It is odd, isn't it?
Sorry?
It is odd. I remember being on a book tour in the north of England. Right. This is donkeys years ago. Must have been late 80s or something.
Yeah.
Going into an Indian restaurant with my publicist in somewhere like Bradford. And they served the Indian food with chips and mushy peas.
Right. did you eat it, or did you have it taken off your plate, or what?
Oh, I think I had it because, you know, you don't want to be the one who stands out like a sore thumb. No. But I remember thinking, how strange is that? They've got to anglicise the food. But, of course, all Indian and Chinese food cooked in England is anglicised. My son spent a term in Shanghai, on an exchange programme from school. And he said, "Mummy, the Chinese food in China is not Chinese food like we get it at home," which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, but was it better or worse, did he say?
No, much worse. It wasn't anything like real Chinese food, like we have in London.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's like when you go to Italy, you know, God, the pizza's disgusting. Not like English pizza at Domino's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, it is. I totally agree with you. Right, okay, Miss Jones, just before we go, I just want to mention the birthday of another extraordinary man, and that is Buzz Aldrin. Who, as I'm sure you know, but not sure how much you know about him, Buzz Aldrin was the second man ever to step on the moon after Neil Armstrong, and Buzz Aldrin's now 91. But an astonishing man who, you know, his mission to space completely changed his life because his head became full of celestial thoughts about Earth can't be the only place in the universe, you know?
Yeah, and he was championing the cause of the voyage to Mars and developed some technology that is probably going to be deployed at some point. Very clever guy. Yeah, I didn't know that he did three spacewalks before the Apollo 11 mission.
Yeah, he did.
That was in 1966. But his head kind of went. I think all their heads kind of went after they came back from the moon. He had clinical depression. He was an alcoholic after he left NASA. He was married three times. His own kids sued him because he was spending their inheritance at a rate of knots. In 2007, when he was 77 years old, he had a facelift.
Yeah. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah, people were saying, why do you need a facelift at the age of 77? And he
That's
said,
right, yeah.
Well, the G-force I was exposed to in space caused my jowl to sag, he said, and that needed some attention. Yeah. Well, I mean, who needs a facelift at 77?
No, I don't know. The most amazing things I've heard about him, because I was fascinated by this man, is that on those spacewalks, the reason why he had three, he was the only astronaut in NASA who, when he exited the space capsule into space, the only astronaut whose blood pressure went down, not up. Every other astronaut, you know, was sort of tense and nervous about going into space. He got more relaxed the further he went into space, which is an amazing thing. And the other thing that sent him mad was everything he'd ever done in life. He was the top pilot in the US Air Force. He was the top guy at the military college he went to. He was the top footballer at his college. He was the top student at university. And the only thing he ever came second in his life was being the second man on the moon. And he couldn't handle it when he got back to Earth.
I understand that. Yeah, but I mean, he was one of only two on that mission who stood on the moon, wasn't he? One of the first two humans to land on the moon. That's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
But I can see that. I can see why he would feel inadequate for that
inadequate.
Reason.
Inadequate? Yeah, I feel inadequate. I'm on the only two human.
After Neil Armstrong, I mean, because Neil Armstrong mopped it all up, didn't he? All the fame and attention and acclaim.
He did,
Buzz Aldrin was the also-ran. That's what I mean.
Golly, you're absolutely right, you know, when you look at it like that. Second man on the moon and just a write-off, you know. Yeah, completely written off. Just before we go, I said that was going to be the last story. We've got a really, really funny one here for you to comment on, Miss Jones. So Vernon Kay is giving one of those My Life Through the Lens interviews, you know, and he has a picture here. Right, in 1993, I had the best time when I moved to London to model. I was scouted by a model agent on a Friday, and within a week, I'd packed in my job working the DIY shop. You know Vernon Kay's, don't you? He's that TV presenter, you know.
Yeah, he's been married to Tess Daly.
That's right, yeah, well done. I packed in my job working a DIY shop, and I was living in a bedsit in Paddington. It all took off from there for me. Looks were never talked about in our family, but my mum, would get compared to actress Linda Carter. But this is the best bit. Listen to this. When the Beatles played two gigs in Bolton, Mum got asked out by all four of them who started fighting over her. She always says, your dad were better looking than any of them Beatles, Vernon. How about that?
Yeah, it's really, I mean, isn't that a bit fanciful? You know, think about the number of girls who passed through the Beatles' dressing room.
Absolutely.
And probably lingered on the way. You know, she was better off marrying Vernon's dad than being used by a pop star. Sorry.
Well, there you go. Blunt and frank as usual from Miss Jones. It's a family show, but she tells it like it is. Okay, folks, that's it for today. Thank you very much. Thank you, Miss Jones. And we will talk again soon.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
There's something a bit weird about that boy, though. He seems to like taking pictures of his mother when she's in bikinis and all her knockers are hanging out and all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know? She's only got two, but a little bit dodgy, yeah.
Yes. Well, sorry, she's only got two what?
Knockers.
What do you
mean? Said all her knockers. Maybe she's got a third kind of one knocking around on the back.
I see what's going on here, Miss Jones. You're trying to make out that you're the wordsmith, eh? And I'm the ignoramus when it comes to the English language, eh?
Not do anus as well.
Excuse me, I didn't say that, you know.
Oh, didn't you?
Okay. No, I didn't. Anyway, listen, it's the...
It's a
family show, it is, and let's keep it as a family show. I remember we were standing in the bar at the King's Head. The more drinks he had, the more incredibly drunk he was getting because he didn't realise...
Well, that's the usual way, yes.
Yeah, seriously, no, yes, I know. What I mean is he didn't realise the strains that Chetbag was putting on his body because he probably hadn't been to sleep now for about 30 hours or something, you know. Mm. And he was going, jet lag, fucking jet lag. He says, you youngsters, you know, fucking... I've been in this game for... 30 fucking years, you know, and all of a sudden he went like, you know, bright red and then white, and he collapsed and smashed his head on the floor. Well, there you go. Blunt and frank as usual from Miss Jones. It's a family show, but she tells it like it is.